Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, and this is our weekly news roundup, when we discuss the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
And later in the program, we'll hear from Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jim Kinsella from the Enterprise Newspapers, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. We'll check in with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times and Andy Tomolonis from SouthCoastToday.com. Now, a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the Islands, Jeff. Starting with what has become a seasonal story, businesses affected by a shortage of H-2B visas. Congressman Bill Keating made an appeal this week on behalf of the Cape's businesses. He asked the Homeland Security Chief to come here to see firsthand the effects of the current policy.
That's right. He did. And, Steve, as summer starts to really get into full swing here, it's really becoming noticeable that there's a lack of workers here. And that's attributable to the new policy in effect for the H-2B visa program, which allows non-agricultural positions to be filled by temporary seasonal workers, foreign workers. The cap on these workers was filled earlier this year. It's only 33,000 for the summer, and the Cape and Islands is competing with the entire country. So realizing that something needs to be done here, and we're in such a state, the congressman did invite Homeland Security Secretary Kirsten Nelson to come here to see how bad it is. And not only is it that the cap of the 33,000 workers has already been filled.
And that's a national cap.
That's a national cap. Yeah. But really what is hitting us hard here in the region is a change in a policy that had existed in the past up until 2017, where returning workers could come back to their jobs without counting toward the gap. The cap. So with that taken away, it really is becoming an issue here, because for quite a long time, for years, some employees would come from Haiti, from Jamaica, go back to the same job season after season after season. Now they're really at the mercy of a lottery system.
And you'd hear employers from the region talk about their employees who came back season after season after season, almost as family. They come year after year. And also they've invested a lot in training people to do very specific jobs.
That's right. And Wendy Northcross from the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce, the CEO, I spoke with her yesterday, and she says, you know, this is quite sad. These are people who are going by the letter of the law. They were coming here, they were working, they were going home and then coming back. But realizing that there was such a shortage, the United States Customs and Immigration Service did, on May 31st, release another 15,000 visas for the summer season. They received so many applications, Steve, that it was Wednesday, I believe, they announced that it's going to have to go back to a lottery system. We're expecting this is going to happen next week. It's a random computer-generated lottery.
It happens in Vermont.
It happens in St. Albans, Vermont. It does. It does.
Who knew? Not the place that you would typically think, yes.
No. And the other thing, you think the lottery system might actually be a little more fair for employers from the Cape and Islands, because they only accept the applications through the mail, Steve. And when the applications were made available for these extra 15,000, there was a little glitch in getting them online. So if they had to be mailed to St. Albans, employees from the islands or even the Outer Cape or other parts of the Cape were kind of at a disadvantage, because it's a first come, first serve. So somebody, for instance, in Bar Harbor may have got it in the mail quicker, would have got there. That's kind of a moot point now, because there were so many applications, but yeah, this could be easier.
But there's nothing for employers now to count on, because it's a lottery. It's the luck of the draw.
That's right. It's the luck of the draw. And also, it's getting late. I mean, it's June 8th right now, and this doesn't happen overnight. But Congressman Keating and a group of his colleagues, a bipartisan group, are working right now to try to get some type of revival of that returning worker policy. They're trying to get it attached as an amendment to a piece of legislation that is well on its way right now in Capitol Hill. So hopefully that will ease some of the issues here. Not a guarantee. Working on it.
And that must depend a little bit on how far back you go who's going to count as a returning worker.
Yeah, he said it's likely not to be quantity-based, like we're going to have 20,000 available, but probably saying, okay, employers, you can go back 2-3 years to get your employees. You can't go and try to get someone who was there 10 years ago. And the congressman did meet with Krista Nielsen this week. There was a
meeting. Homeland Security chief.
He met with a group, he said a fairly significant size group of congressmen and senators, bipartisan, bicameral from both houses. And he said she left there realizing the urgency of the situation and how it's affecting not only resort areas but other places all around the country.
How about the invitation for her to come here? Any word on that?
The one thing I asked him that, and he said, well, she didn't say no.
Okay. She's probably waiting for August to come here.
That's right.
July.
That's right.
The right moment to come to the Cape and the Islands. You were among the Cape Cod Times reporters, Jeff, who covered a murder trial that's happening this week. This is a trial in the killing of Mary Frat Antonio, who was a local teacher.
She was. She was a 35-year-old special education teacher at Barnesville High School. She was stabbed to death in her bedroom. It was February 28th, last day of February in 2017, allegedly by her husband, Christopher Frat Antonio, and he's on trial this week. He's admitted he has done it. He said so to police after the incident, as well as in a recorded interrogation. But I have to say, and just spending that one day there, the case goes, as I said, goes on today, likely to go to a jury this afternoon. This case had everything that you would think of, and I had to compare it to a soap opera or a Lifetime movie. It started out with a marriage that was definitely on the rocks, but suspicions of infidelity, drug addiction, social media espionage, I call it, people looking at what texts were sent and Facebook, and financial hardship. But quite a few witnesses coming to the stand, people who had got calls right after it happened. He had actually sent text messages saying, I just killed my wife, and a pretty gory photograph attached to it.
He sent a text message with this photograph.
With a photo. Yeah. And very gory. And some of his coworkers had said they had heard him talk about it, that there were issues, and kind of thought he was making an off-the-cuff remark when he'd say, oh, I think I'm going to kill my wife. A horrible... Sad story. It also seems as if she was struggling with an addiction to prescription opioids at the time and was really just days away from an intervention and going to a rehabilitation center.
Another aspect of this sad story, tragic, is that the couple's two children were at home at the time.
They were there, a two-year-old and a six-year-old.
Mm. We're going to speak now with Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Sarah, the company Vineyard Wind has been in the news a lot as it prepares to build the state's first offshore wind farm. The last company to come close to that, Cape Wind, is packing up its efforts, and that includes a weather tower out on Horseshoe Shoal. Tell us about this.
It does, yeah. That's one of the last symbols of the failed Cape Wind project, and this was one of the first physical symbol of Cape Wind that we're talking about, which is this 200-foot-tall meteorological tower that's out on Horseshoe Shoal off the eastern side of the Vineyard, kind of between the Vineyard and Nantucket, where the Cape Wind project was slated to be built. And it's a weather monitoring tower that was put up, I think, in 2003 to gather information about wind speed, which is obviously an important thing to know for a potential wind project, and other information about conditions out there. And at the time, Cape Wind was going to be the first offshore wind farm in the United States, and this was kind of the first structure that they built, not without a little bit of contention about it, but it'd been up since then, and a lot of people are probably aware, as you said, that, you know, Cape Wind surrendered its lease last year. It's been kind of, as you said, packing up. So this is the next thing to go, and the Army Corps of Engineers right now is reviewing a permit request from Cape Wind to take the tower down, and a decision is expected by mid-June or so, and it would take an estimated 22 days for the tower to come down out there. And one thing that's interesting is that during the project, the owner of Patriot Party Boats, which goes between Oak Bluffs and Falmouth Harbor, they would take researchers from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution over to maintain the tower and collect data. And he said the tower really became a magnet for sea bass and bluefish. So I guess that marker will disappear, so fishermen will have to work around that. But Meanwhile, too, as you mentioned, Vineyard Wind, which was recently given the right to sign a lease for a potential new wind project south of the vineyard, they recently released an 11-foot solar-powered buoy that will gather wind speed and wave height and water temperature in the area where that is potentially going to be developed, and that will be out there for a few months. So kind of this new project south of the vineyard is getting underway while this project, the Cape Wind project, seems to be winding down.
Let me ask you briefly about another piece of island news. A former vacation home for the Obama family has sold.
Yeah, anything, you know, that has to do with presidential history and real estate always gets a lot of attention. And this week there was news about this home in Chilmark, where then-President Obama stayed during his summer vacation on the vineyard back in 2013. It's off South Road and was owned by David and Patty Schulte, who live in Chicago, and they're not in the vineyard. And it sold last Friday for $15 million to an LLC represented by a law firm in New York City. It's a beautiful home, infinity pool, basketball court. It's a lovely property with great views of the South Shore. The sale price didn't include an additional $2.35 million for art and furnishings. And it did, like you said, the Obamas stayed there. And, you know, it does have that claim to fame. It also happened to be a little too close to the road for the comfort of Secret Service. So when the Obamas stayed there, it resulted in the closure of the road, which, you know, certainly was not to the pleasure of abutters and some of the local businesses. So that was the only time the Obamas stayed there. But it looks like this is going to have new ownership, and they will have that claim to fame for their house.
Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. Sarah, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Jeff Spillane. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. And on the phone with us right now is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, interesting story about how Chatham Elementary School may provide free lunches for all students in the fall.
Yes, this came to light during a recent audit. The Monomoy school officials learned that the number of students at Chatham Elementary School who currently receive free or reduced-cost meals exceeds the threshold for a federal government program that will provide free breakfast and lunch for all students in a school. Just over 46% of kids at the school right now qualify for free or reduced-cost meals. And that qualifies the school for what's called the Community Eligibility Provision Program through the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which is administered by the Massachusetts Department of Elementary and Secondary Education. Now, under this program, if more than 40% of students in a particular school or district meet the qualification for free or reduced cost meals, the school can apply to obtain a federal subsidy that allows all students to receive free meals. Now, what this means is that families will no longer have to fill out paperwork to apply or to qualify for meal subsidies, and the school won't have to keep track of all that paperwork or worry about processing it, or work to collect on lunch accounts that are in arrears, because right now any child in the school, whether they qualify for the subsidized meal or not, if they don't have the money or they can't afford a meal, they're given food, but their account, every kid has an account, their account is debited. The school won't have to worry about collecting those debts, which they have to do now. Now, as we know, healthy and nutritious meals at both breakfast and lunch, experts say that that's very important for learning. And if the school can provide free lunches and breakfasts for everyone, that will go a long way, they say, to helping kids, certain kids in those situations. Now, it probably comes as a surprise to some people that Chatham Elementary School would fall into this category.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for comparison, 38% of students at Harwich Elementary School qualify for the meal subsidy, so they're below that threshold. But, like an analysis last year that we had talked about that found that 17 students in the Monomoy District met the definition of homelessness, it kind of demonstrates that there's a lot of hidden problems, hidden issues in these communities and in Chatham. And it shows how much working families with children especially are struggling. And Superintendent Scott Carpenter said that he often gets a surprise reaction when he talks about this to parents and other groups. And this is through this program, this is one way the school department hopes to help some of those families. And at this point, the school is in the process of applying to the program, which they have to do by the end of this month. And they expect that they'll qualify and they will implement it when classes begin in September.
Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times is with me. Jeff, one of the largest pieces of farmland on the Cape was in the news this week. It's a property that's apparently not being used for farming, and that's a big part of the problem, according to the Attorney General.
That's right. There's not that many 223-acre plots of land left here on the Cape, Steve.
But I had not heard of this farmland
before.
Nor did I.
Yeah. It's in the Forestdale section of Sandwich. It's called Windstar Farm. It was a working farm for forever, pretty much, but has fallen into rack and ruin since it was purchased in 1995. Well, last week, Attorney General Mara Healey's office said to the owners, you need to clean this up, maintain it, and restore it back to where it can be used as a farm. And that includes taking security measures to stop trespassing on the property and vandalism that's gone on there. People are in there setting fires, dumping trash, riding dirt bikes and ATVs. And they've even found boats and cars dumped on the property.
Oh,
so, but the gist of the Attorney General's decision was, in 1982, when it was owned by another property owner, a preservation restriction was put on the property, and the state of Massachusetts paid almost $1 million for that, $990,000, that said, hey, you got to maintain this property for agricultural use in perpetuity.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously they hadn't lived up to that. So right now it's unusable, unsuitable for agriculture. It's overgrown with weeds, invasive plants. Destroyed, the irrigation's destroyed. So this owner really has some work to do. They got to remove all the trash, the overgrowth, and plant. They want them to plant a cover crop to help in the refurbishment, as well as institute a soil nutrient management program and try to get this back to where it should be used for agricultural purposes.
And all that from the Attorney General, but no word from the folks who own the property apparently
on
that.
No.
Some property owners in Falmouth Heights area may be facing fines soon, and this has to do with sewer hookups.
Yeah, there's 26 homes in Falmouth Heights that have not yet hooked up to what they call the Little Pond Sewer System. It's a $30 million project that the town embarked upon a few years back. And if they don't do it soon, Steve, they're going to be paying $50 per day if they don't hook up to it. And apparently the town has sent them letters. They go back to 2016, four letters, and there's been no response. And what's interesting here is the letters are going out to the addresses the town has for in the assessor's database. That's where the information for tax bills and water bills go. So people are paying those bills, but they're not hooking up to the sewer. So these people need to do it pretty quickly or they're going to be really paying a fine. And I didn't know this, but I looked it up this morning. I was just wondering to myself, well, how much does that cost? Because it's at the owner's expense.
Right.
And according to a sewer site I was on today, average nationally is $1,400, but it can be as high as $3,000.
To hook up to the sewer system.
To hook up to the sewer
system. For an individual homeowner.
But and that $50 a day fine could easily get there pretty quickly. So
it could. I guess there's some question about getting a hold of people and the select board suggesting that they ought to be making phone calls.
That's right. And it should be mentioned in that area, there's 461 homes, 435 have done it.
Let me go to a story about a sad story from Mashpee this week about a memorial that was stolen from a Gold Star family.
Yeah, about 10 years ago, Mashpee really was hit hard with deaths of soldiers in active duty. One of them was Daniel McGuire, who was killed in 2008. His family has, during the Memorial Day period, puts out a life-size silhouette of a kneeling soldier in their front lawn just as a way to remember him and this Gold Star family. And over the weekend, last weekend, it was stolen. really upsetting, not only the family and the neighborhood, but the whole community. And there's a sign up now, just please put it back. It has gained a lot of attention, a lot of news, even off Cape in the Boston area. The mother, Daniel's mother, Kay, placed on Facebook a message saying, a plea, don't destroy it. Find a way to return it. It means nothing to you, but a lot to us. And there's also some veterans groups here on the Cape that said they're going to help the family obtain a new one and even help monitor the property moving forward. So Mashpee Police Department wants to hear of anyone from anyone who may know anything about this missing memorial.
You think about the loss this family experienced once with their son and now to have the memorial taken by somebody. And even if it was, as they say, perhaps a prank or somebody kind of thoughtlessly doing this, it's still another painful moment for them.
It is. It is.
Local politics is your beat. And a story this week about an ad campaign targeting our local state senator. Tell us about
that. Yeah, that's our Cape and Islands District Senator Julian Sear. Now, we're about 5 months away from the general election, and there will only be a general election for Cape and Islands Senator because there will be no primaries. It will be Senator Sear facing off against Republican Barnstable Town Councilor John Flores. There's an organization in Boston called the Mass Fiscal Alliance. It's known for its scathing marketing campaigns and tactics against against liberal politicians. Senator Sear has been the target of their campaigns 3 times now in 6 months. The most recently was last week, really hitting Senator Sear for voting for the pay raise for Beacon Hill lawmakers shortly after he took office in 2017. And this is the second time they've done it. What's different this time is Mass Fiscal Alliance. In the past, they've only sent the mailers targeting Senator Sear to certain towns on the Cape, realizing it's probably not a good use of money, some say up to $25,000, to go to the Outer Cape, to go to the Vineyard, to go to Nantucket, some of the more liberal areas. This time, they did it to all 19 towns in the district. And Sear's camp is coming back, referring to the organization as dark money. It's a super PAC, and that it's just really an attack ad.
I thought it was interesting then as they people call into Sear's office, they're giving them this information and they're and people are kind of surprised to find out what some of this conversation
is. Yes, they are. And they're telling me that oftentimes, because there was a call to action on the mail piece to call Senator Sear's office, that when they talk with these people, they often turn them around and the anger goes toward the Mass Fiscal Alliance. Should also mention the Sear organization did hit the Mass Fiscal Alliance for not using recycled paper either on the 100,000 direct mail pieces.
We're going to speak now with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Steve. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. Casey, the Outer Cape Health is going to be closing its Wellfleet office for a period while it expands. You have details about this along with just a fantastic photograph of the building and the staff from when it first opened.
Yes, that's right. The Outer Cape Health Services building in Wellfleet is 52 years old. It's the original Outer Cape Health Services Clinic, and it was built in 1966 as the Association for Improving Medical Resources of Outer Cape Cod. It's the only clinic in the Outer Cape. It's the only health services offered in the Outer Cape, so it's really very important out here. And yes, the building in Wellfleet must close for this reconstruction to take place in a timely and affordable way. So in November, patients will need to either go to the Provincetown Clinic or the Harwichport Clinic, where they'll be seen until construction is complete, and the new building is expected to open in June of 2019. The Council on Aging's in neighboring towns have indicated they'll help transport people who can't drive themselves. And the timing of this is supposed to coincide with the opening of the new Harwichport Clinic, which is going from a very small five exam room building on Chatham Road to a 18 exam room clinic in Harwichport. So hopefully that timing will work out. That's supposed to open in November. And we talked to Patricia Nadel, who is the executive director of Outer Cape Health Services, and she said doing the Harwichport facility first before the Wellfleet one, which has been necessary for a long time, was important for economic reasons because the most growth potential for patients is in the Harwich area, and they also think they may be able to attract a more year-round employee base as well. And that'll help them financially since the Lower Cape as opposed to the Outer Cape is much more year-round. So the building in Wellfleet is going to be 50% larger than the current building. So it's going from 5,000 to 7,500 square feet. And it will have kind of a, they call it a racetrack design inside, so that the medical team will have their workstations in the center of a large open space with the exam rooms fanning out around it. So it's kind of exciting, yeah. And I think the uniforms that the people are going to be wearing are going to be a lot different than the 1966 uniforms that you see in the picture in our paper.
The picture is a nice picture. People should go and take a look at it. Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner. Casey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to speak with Jim Kinsella at the Enterprise Newspapers. Good morning, Jim.
Morning, Steve.
Jim, you have a story about the Sandwich Archives preparing to digitize some historic newspapers based in the town. Tell us about this.
Yeah, the Friends of the Sandwich Town Archives, they've went and gotten together with the Community Preservation Committee that helps fund efforts and endeavors, community-minded efforts such as this one. And they said, well, you know, at this point we've got these sort of historic newspapers and that were published in Sandwich at various times in the 1800s and 1900s, but they say that they're all on microfilm, and so you can go and you can kind of view them on a microfilm reader, but you, for example, you can't print from the microfilm. You have to make an appointment to go in and see it. The other problem that they've got is the microfilm just by putting your finger on the microfilm, the oils in your finger begin to destroy the film. Mm. So they would like to, obviously, to preserve it for true historical preservation. What they're proposing is digitizing it, setting it up so it could be viewed, and actually could be viewed by anyone, basically anywhere in the world. The Sandwich Library would pay the host fee on this, and people could view these things. The first paper that they want to digitize is called the Sandwich Observer. That was published between 1845 and 1851. And if you know something about the history of Sandwich, that's right around the peak years of the Boston and Sandwich Glass Company. Sandwich very famously being associated with glass production, and that newspaper was publishing in those years.
From 1845 to 1851 is what you said?
Yep, that's correct.
That's an old newspaper.
Well, it certainly is, but the information in that paper is much like the information you would get in the newspaper today, and provides a real window, mm-hmm. people with the archives say, of community life at that time. You see the names of the people who are in the community and what's going on in it.
And then these records, once they're digitized, will also be searchable. Is that right? So people can look for stories
right.
from this time.
Right. As I mentioned, they're going to, it would seem here to be accessible via the Internet. So you could sort of access it through the online computer library center. And you could be in Tokyo, Japan, and be checking out what was going on in Sandwich in 1847. That's the plan.
Jim Kinsella from the Enterprise Newspapers. Jim, thanks for joining us with that story.
You're welcome, Steve.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we're going to speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point, and we're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. On the phone with us right now is George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve, and good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, George.
George, the CEO of Martha's Vineyard Hospital was in front of a public forum this week. The hospital has had a bit of a rough ride since the last CEO was fired abruptly last year. Tell us about this event this week, and what was it like?
Yeah, it was interesting. This is, of course, CEO Denise Schapici, and she took over for Joe Wooden, who had been fired by the board of directors of the hospital. And sort of ironically, the day of this meeting was Tuesday, and it was 1 year to the day that Wooden was abruptly fired at the hospital. And listeners, I'm sure, remember that that set off a firestorm over the summer and into the fall. People saying that the hospital lacked transparency because they thought Wooden was doing a good job. He had only been there about a year, but you know, he was doing some of the community interactions that Denise has done as well. So that took people by surprise, and they said they wanted more transparency. So Denise took over in January, and you know, she came in promising a more open, transparent process. And part of what she said she wanted to do is one of these open forums. And that was held on Tuesday. It was very much like a town meeting,
mm-hmm.
Where you know, people could get up at a microphone and ask a question about issues at the hospital.
And, the meeting, tell us where the meeting was held, so we have an idea.
Yeah, so it was at the Martha's Vineyard Regional High School in the Performing Arts mm-hmm. Center. So a fairly big venue, and there were 150 to 200 people there. Quite a showing on a Tuesday evening when there is a lot of other stuff happening on the island, but people were really engaged in this. She promised to be there for an hour and a half and actually stayed a little bit longer to make sure all the questions were addressed. She gave a little bit of insight into herself and you know how she came to love the island. You know, she came here as a teenager. She grew up in East Boston, you know, sort of the extended family with her grandparents. And, you know, she recalled swimming in Boston Harbor, which kind of got a little hushed, you know, in the crowd. And
a different time,
imagine,
yes.
Imagine when I came to Martha's Vineyard, you know, how I felt. And she said, someday I knew I would live here. And she did come to purchase a house here about 18 years ago. Her husband recently retired, and she thought she was going to retire too, but then this opportunity presented itself. And, you know, I have to say, you know, she was very engaging, but also very direct. You know, if there was something that, you know, the hospital simply couldn't do, she was honest with people and said, look, we're never going to have abortion services on Martha's Vineyard because there's not enough call for it, and we wouldn't be able to do it well here.
Mm-hmm.
So we have services in place to refer people, and counsel people, and that's what they'll continue to do. And she was also able to admit mistakes. You know, there was one woman in particular. We didn't name her because she talked about a medical procedure that she went to the hospital for, but you know, she said, you know, she should have been offered an alternative to an opioid for a colonoscopy because, mm-hmm. you know, she had, you know, what if she were drug addicted? And Denise said, you know, we made a mistake there, and we'll redouble our efforts to make sure our staff is trained properly to deal with those situations.
George, one of the questions that we've heard a lot coming out from the island about healthcare is primary care. How did she address primary care services on the island?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. Just prior to this meeting, she hired three doctors, and those doctors will come on board in September. Primary care doctors,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Three additional ones. Plus, she's added the name's escaping me, Steve. Help me out here. Nurse practitioners,
mm-hmm,
thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So she's hired a bunch of nurse practitioners as well, and that's new here. You'd go to a primary care physician almost exclusively, but nurse practitioners can do almost everything that a medical doctor can do, and they do it in consultation with a primary care doctor. And her point was that she enjoys going to a nurse practitioner because they tend to spend more time with the patient, more time than a doctor can spend. So that's an interesting addition to what people are used to here on the island. And she thinks people are going to be seen a lot quicker than they're used to as a result of having both primary care physicians and nurse practitioners at the hospital.
Does it sound like they're going to have another forum?
Yeah, so she's really interested in having this type of a forum again in the future, and she's hired a communications director who's already doing a lot on Facebook, and she's also doing other forms of social media. So people are really excited about the fact that the hospital seems to have gotten the message that they need to communicate better with the public. You know, she even gave some insight into the hospital's budget, you know, saying that, you know, so far this year they're about $3 million behind where they were the previous year. Some of that is some of the hiring that she's done mm-hmm. already. But she expects to be able to catch up by the end of the year. So lots of interesting things happening there. And, you know, we'll see how it goes moving forward.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks.
Thanks so much, Steve. Have a good weekend.
Yep. We are going to speak now with Andy Tomolonis at SouthCoastToday.com and the New Bedford Standard Times. Good morning, Andy.
Hi, Steve.
Andy, a town on the South Coast is going the way of an increasing number of other towns across the state in passing a plastic bag ban, but this is a first for the South Coast. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. So it was voters at Dartmouth's town meeting this week. They joined the growing ranks, as you say, of the communities across Massachusetts that are taking action against, you know, these disposable plastic bags. So they voted to ban the thin film bags. They litter the highways. They get stuck in tree branches. And you know what a danger they are to the marine life and everything else. What I think is important here is that Dartmouth's a really big community. And geographically, is one of the largest towns in Massachusetts. But it's also a big retail center for this area. There are malls and plazas, so it has the ability to affect surrounding communities, you know, people who live, you know, any of the current communities around here, New Bedford, Freetown, other South Coast. They shop at the malls and the plazas and the big box stores that are in Dartmouth. So it could help clean up the area around here. And it's interesting that, you know, Dartmouth's bag restriction, it's still subject to review by State Attorney General, but that's with all town meeting articles. But it is a sensible law, I think. First, it targets the thin bags that are sometimes doubled up, and you know these bags create a mess everywhere. And there are some smart exceptions for small businesses, so it excludes smaller scale retailers, businesses with less than 5,000 square feet of floor space, mm-hmm. and all the prepackaged things. They're not outlawed in your home, so you can use them in your home, and you know, anything that's prepackaged goods that's already comes in those bags, they can be sold, as well as things like meats, deli, cheeses, seafood, stuff that's packaged before you get to the register. So yeah, it's a smart law, and it's going to take a year after Attorney General approves the law before it takes effect. Now, this thing is happening across the state. I know there's some Cape Cod communities that are doing these bans. Falmouth was one, I think.
Yes.
So statewide now there are more than 75 communities that have done this, and there's a few communities in our area who are considering it, and there's a statewide bill pending. But the legislative session ends June 30th, and so there's no guarantee of what a state law would be if it's approved this season. So all of that's very interesting, and you know it's an ongoing thing. So if the state law takes effect now as it's written, if it's approved, it would supersede the regulations of the local towns by about, I think it's August of 2019.
Hmm. Andy, I want to ask you about another story in your paper. A man with quite a life story who was a New Bedford native has passed away. He was 105 years old when he passed away, and his life is just remarkable. Tell us just a little about him.
Sure. You're talking about Judge George Layton. So he died Wednesday at a veterans hospital in Virginia after battling pneumonia. And as you say, he was 105 years old. And so, you know, this judge did the swearing in for New Bedford Mayor Mitchell when he was 101 years old. So, you know, he was healthy and had his wits about him. So the city lowered all its flags to half staff yesterday in his remembrance. But Judge Layton was a really accomplished person. He was the first African-American appointed to a federal seat as a judge for the Northern District of Illinois. And he served that position from 1976 when he was appointed by Gerald Ford until he retired in 1987. So because he was appointed by Ford, he was the first Democrat ever appointed to a federal judgeship by a Republican. And despite his achievements, he was a pretty down-to-earth guy. Our story quoted Dr. Bruce Rose, who's president of the New Bedford chapter of the NAACP, and he said he was a very humble guy. You have your image of him as this accomplished individual, but he speaks to you like he's one of your friends.
Mm.
So, yes, and he had a humble background. He was raised as a boy by Cape Verdean immigrants on the island of Brava. He grew up as a chess player, an avid chess player in New Bedford and the Cape Cod area. And he worked in Cranberry Bogs as a youngster. He was accepting award here in New Bedford in 2012. And this is interesting. He recalled a story about how he hitchhiked his way from New Bedford to Howard University in Washington, D.C., and he convinced the university to admit him, despite the fact that he didn't have a high school education.
Andy Tomalonis from SouthCoastToday.com. Andy, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
Jeff Spillane is with me from the Cape Cod Times. Jeff, savings in energy costs will be coming to many Cape and Islands homeowners. It looks like Cape and Vineyard electric customers will see these savings.
Yeah, this is something you don't hear of a lot, Steve. This is the Cape Light Compact, which is the municipal electricity aggregator for the 15 towns on the Cape and the 6 towns on the Vineyard. And they announced last week that starting this month, or you'll see it in July's bill, that customers are going to get a rate decrease.
That is a nice surprise.
It is. It's a very nice surprise. And they have 139,000 customers, both residential, commercial, and some industrial customers here on the Cape. So it's affecting a lot of people. I'm guessing the majority of electricity customers here on the Cape. And rates are going to go down, at least for the rest of this year, from 12.8% per kilowatt hour to 10.6 cents for residential customers. In total, for the 6-month period, customers collectively are going to save about $2.6 million, about $12 a month on the average bill. But don't see this a lot.
Jeff, I want to ask you about a story about a popular ice cream shop in Dennis that has lost a legal fight, which means it may soon be looking for a new location. And I know there's two sides to this story.
Yeah, there are two sides to the story. And, you know, I've not been there, but from what all I can read about here, it's a very beloved ice cream shop in Dennis, and looks like it may have to find a new location or perhaps close. The Ice Cream Smuggler is the name of the shop. It's now in its 40th season. They're open. And last week, the Massachusetts Appeals Court upheld a ruling back last year from the Barnstable Superior Court, saying that the property owner did not have to extend the lease to the owners of the business, and that lease expired in May 2017. The owners had signed on with the Cape Cod Creamery, which, of course, is a competing ice cream vendor. But the owners of the ice cream shop, Paul and Carter Catalano, said they were never given the chance to even negotiate the lease. So that's how it ended up in court. And Barnstable Court said, hey, you know, there's no violation here, but since they did appeal the decision, they could stay open until it was resolved. And so that was a year ago. Now it seems to be resolved. So the question is, what happens now? Will there be an eviction notice served on the shop that's open for the summer? Which I have to say, there's been a big campaign on social media to save the smuggler. They've been selling T-shirts and all that. And the daughter of the property owner said that it's best to let the party that didn't prevail exit gracefully. So it'll be interesting to see what happens here.
Jeff, Brewster's town administrator is facing a number of questions, some of them about accounting and finances.
Yeah, it's getting a little chippy down there in Brewster, Steve, in town hall. Michael Embry, who is a town administrator, first off, he acknowledged this week that there has been a complaint filed against him by a town employee. We don't know what exactly that complaint is about, but he did say it was nothing, hashtag Me Too related or had to deal with the sexual harassment. But that's not all. He may be in some hot water for not following state procurement laws. The town's finance director is on an extended medical leave, so he worked with an employment agency to bring in an interim finance director. Not inexpensive to hire someone with that, that level of expertise, but if you surpass $10,000, you need to be subjected to the procurement laws, which means it needs to go out to bid. So the concern is there. You know, this interim director came out in May. That $10,000 is, if they haven't reached that yet, it will be soon. So that's going to be an issue. And the reason why that interim finance director was needed, because the finance director who's on medical leave, a woman named Irene Larravee, had been criticized about 3 days before she went on leave for questionable accounting practices related to internal controls and a lot of reconciliation entries to balance the books and some data errors. So there were some questions about what was going on there. Then she goes out on an extended medical leave. So she, in turn, has filed an open meeting law complaint saying she wasn't allowed to address the Board of Selectmen, the Select Board, when they talked about this. And to take it a little step further, the town administrator and this woman, Irene Larravee, came back and said, hey, you know, the former town administrator and finance director, they had their issues too. It just created quite a bit of mess down there. So the former town administrator is saying, hey, you know, let's, what documentation do you have to make those allegations?
To make those kinds of accusations.
They haven't heard anything. So real, real interesting stuff going on down there.
One more story I want to talk about here has to do with fire pits. And there was an injury last week to a child, and it's raised a number of safety questions about fire pits. Your reporter, Doug Frazier, takes a closer look at fire pits and their regulations around their use.
They do. You know, fire pits seem to be everywhere these days. A lot of people, and you have them in their backyards, and they've just become very popular. Last Friday night, a 7-year-old at the Cape Codder Resort in Hyannis, popular amongst that age group because it has a water park, fell into a fire pit, was severely injured, had to be med-flighted to Boston, bringing up a lot of safety questions. Now that there's so many of these fire pits, what are some of the rules and regulations? There are some that may not be enough. I should also mention earlier last week, a 71-year-old woman in Worcester fell in and died.
Into a fire pit.
Into a fire pit. The Hyannis Fire District says, hey, you know, with the Cape Codder, they do call in every night for a verbal permit to start the fire. We don't want them to do it if they were successfully windy or dry. And they gave some suggestions and advice. Only burn clean wood, never any trash. That can cause the fire to combust. Place in, the fire pits on even surfaces. If you have any children or adults that are unsteady, you could fall in. Keep it away from buildings. And some of these, you know, kind of make sense. You'd think you'd already do them, but they just want to reiterate it. Keep a hose nearby. And also there are screens you can buy to put over these fire pits, which would stop some of the embers from flying out and children from putting their hands in. And what I thought was interesting, the spokesperson for the Mass Department of Fire Services said keep a circle of safety about 3 feet around the fire pit, especially for children and dogs. And then your quote, which makes perfect sense to me, that's why we use long sticks to roast marshmallows.
You know, I was surprised to see in this article, too, that until several years ago, recreational fire pits weren't even legal in Massachusetts.
Right.
I didn't know that.
That's
so that's kind of why it seems like they're proliferating right now, and you can see them popping up.
Yeah,
so many different
places. I probably haven't heard the last about this.
That's our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guests, Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. Jeff, thank you for joining us. We spoke with Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jim Kinsella of the Enterprise Newspapers. We checked in with Casey Myers of the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan, the Martha's Vineyard Times, and Andy Tomalonis of SouthCoastToday.com. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.